It's really true. Sometimes our ideas of reverence and our ideas of the awe of God allows us to miss the fact that we're supposed to be having fun. We can do both. We can have a reverence. We can have an awe. And, you know, at times that takes us into that very, very silent and I suppose, serious place in terms of our outward appearance and all. But even then, even in the midst of those times that the theologians call numinous awe, even at those times, there can be that internal dancing going on. You know, that internal kid just jumping around with the hands up in the air. That's the way we should be living our lives. And that's the thing about music. Besides keeping me a little younger than I actually am, and being in my therapy twice a week, it's a chance to be able to just let the kid come out and play, and it's so much fun. Especially when we can do some of those old songs from when I was young. You know? If you're old enough to remember when those songs were new, you're old. Oh, my goodness. Well, we are in the midst of a red letter study. We're in the midst of hearing what Jesus has to say. The red letters are the letters that are sometimes printed in red ink in certain editions of the Bible to set them off. And we're just kind of going through the red letters. And we are two-thirds of the way through the Sermon on the Mount. And for those of you who are here for the first time, and I know there's a few here, the Sermon on the Mount is basically the encapsulation of all of Jesus' teaching. If you get the Sermon on the Mount, if you understand his concepts and what he's trying to get across there, it's the Rosetta Stone, it's the decoder ring to the rest of the New Testament, and really the rest of the Bible itself. Understanding what Jesus means by kingdom, understanding what he means by living in kingdom, will take in everything that is said in the New Testament one way or another, and gives us the essence of this way of living life. And again, for those of you who are new, kingdom is not a place. Kingdom is not a thing to be grasped. Kingdom is a quality of life that we can enjoy when we are connected, one with God's presence and each other's presence in the moment, right here, right now. Kingdom is not heaven of the next life. If you think that, and we typically do, then everything that Jesus is trying to get across in the Sermon on the Mount, in the rest of the New Testament, everything Paul is trying to get across in the epistles, is going to be skewed by that misunderstanding. And we will not be able to grasp the complete, unadulterated, unabridged, uncompromised, unconditional love of God. We will never be able to get that. Because if we think there's any behavior that can make him love us more or make us love him less, let me turn that around. If we think there's any behavior that will make him love us more or make him love us less, then we are going to be living in fear. We're going to be living in that place that we're coming from, a lack that needs to be filled, and we're constantly striving to fill it, rather than what Jesus was talking about in terms of the good news. The good news is we come from a place of abundance. Everything is already there for us. There is a love for us and acceptance that we cannot lose because we can't gain it either. Getting that peace, not just intellectually in your head, but experientially, all the way down to your socks, is what changes your life. That's the born-again experience. To see life, to see reality from God's point of view, from the place of abundance, instead of our point of view, the place of need and lack and striving, changes everything about the way we experience life. This is what Jesus is trying to get across here. And it's really all he's trying to get across. Throughout the New Testament, throughout all of his ministry, it was one point. Get that, get it all. Seek first the kingdom and God's righteousness. That's that quality of life. God's righteousness, unity in the moment, here, now, and all else is added. That's what he's trying to get across to us. So essential. So we just are leaving Matthew 6. Last week we finished Matthew 6. We're moving into Matthew 7 today. Matthew 6 ended with what I just said. Seek first the kingdom and God's righteousness, and all else is added. So don't worry. Don't worry. Don't think about the future. Don't take thought for the future, because the day has enough troubles of its own. And we all agreed that's pretty true. So here we are always worrying. Here we are always are projecting forward. And Jesus is saying, don't do that. Stay here. Stay now. Give us the bread of our need this day. Second line of the Lord's Prayer. It's this day. It's what's going on right here, right now that matters. And so we make this transition from chapter 6 to chapter 7. And from our point of view, in our Western modern Christian Bibles, we have all these neat chapter headings and verse headings, and it looks to us, because normally when you shift from chapter to chapter, you're shifting from topic to topic, from subject to subject. There should be a break there. But not necessarily so when it comes to Scripture. You know, some of you might not know this, because I didn't know it until I read it. The chapter and verse headings in the Bible were not added until about the 14th century. I want you to stop and think about that for just a second. Chapter and verse headings were not added until probably about the 1300s. That means for at least 1,200 years, people were just dealing with text from beginning to end. And not only that, in the ancient languages of Greek and Hebrew, you didn't parse words and you didn't parse sentences. That means there are no spaces between words. There are no spaces between sentences. There was no punctuation. There are no periods or commas or semicolons. Not only that, they wrote all in capitals in Greek. And not only that, in Hebrew, they didn't include vowels. It was just strings of capital consonants. And what they did was, to conserve paper, because they're writing on parchment and very expensive papyrus and things that are difficult, as well as the ink, to prepare, they needed to maximize what they could get on each sheet. So they wrote in justified columns, full justified columns, straight on each side for the most part. And they would count so many characters across, especially the Jews. So they'd get to the number of characters they could fit on a line, and they'd just start on the next line. Didn't matter if it broke in the middle of a word. It just is a string. If you can imagine that in English, what that would look like on an English page. All the words just run together with no punctuation and stopping at a predetermined character number at the end of each column and starting on the next line. How difficult that would be to read. That was our books of the Bible. Without anything in between, just flowing from beginning to end, just a stream of text. So to automatically imagine that there is a topic change from chapter to chapter, or even from verse to verse, is not necessarily so. And in this case, I don't believe it is so. I think what Jesus is doing is continuing to talk about the topic that he was hitting so hard at the end of Matthew 6. He's telling us not to worry. Don't worry about what you're going to wear. Don't worry about what you're going to eat. You know, the birds of the air, yeah, they are working constantly, but they're not thinking about tomorrow. Tomorrow takes you out of today. Today is the only place that you will ever experience kingdom. So stay here. Stay now. Don't move off of the spot. Seek first the kingdom. And then across that imaginary line to chapter 7, don't judge. Now, if we take this don't judge section completely disconnected from what was happening before it, we can get all sorts of ideas and interpretations about where Jesus is going with this. But if we connect it and we see where he's headed with this and we put it back into the Hebrew context, a very different picture emerges about what Jesus is telling us when he says not to judge. Let's take a look at the target verses there at Matthew 7, 1 and 2. It's either up on your screens. If you have your books, go ahead and open them up, or just take a look in the bulletin. Matthew 7, 1 and 2, do not judge so that you will not be judged. For in the way that you judge, you will be judged. And by your standard of measure, it will be measured to you. Okay, so if you just take that, one section. In English, in our normal context, in the way that we think about things and the world and words, what does that mean to us? What does it look like it means to us? Disconnected from kingdom or anything else. See, to us, it sounds punitive. To us, it sounds like if we do something wrong, then God or someone else is going to do something wrong back to us. We're going to get punished. We're going to get corrected. Something bad is going to happen later on if we do this bad thing now. And of course, the question is, why is it bad? Is it bad because Jesus said it's bad? Is it bad because it's in some sort of law? Is it bad because it's in some sort of moral code? What's the standard by which we judge that judging is bad? I mean, how do we do that? And what is this thing that's going to happen to us? You know, how is this going to happen? Looking through Western eyes, that's what we see. We do something wrong, certain amount of time elapses, maybe it's in heaven. then something bad is going to happen to us. We're going to get judged if we judge. Now let's take a look and see if we can start to move ourselves into an Eastern setting, move ourselves into an ancient Hebrew world and find out what really is going on here. And if you have your bulletins, take a look because there's a chart in there that I want to refer to right now. And I want to go over three keys to try to understand Jesus' words from a Hebrew and Aramaic point of view, because this is key. We're going to miss the entire point of what's going on if we don't get this. Western civilization, Western society, Western thought is dominated by two things. It's Greek philosophy and Roman law. We who are heirs to the European tradition come out of the Greek and Roman empires. Greek philosophy and Roman law. The Romans just adopted Greek philosophy for the most part. What they added to the mix was their form of law. And at the core of Greek philosophy is this notion of dualism. Dualism means that the world is comprised of separate and opposite and sometimes equal forces that are in opposition with each other. You know, the quintessential one is matter and spirit. Spirit and matter. Spirit is good, matter is evil. They're in cosmic opposition to each other. And the idea, as the church adopted this idea of dualism, is that the more spiritual we're going to get, the less physical we need to get, because matter is evil. And so you have people running around, you know, flagellating themselves, whipping themselves, keeping their bodies in constant pain, because and not eating, you know, fasting and doing all these things to take themselves out of the physical world, to take them outside of any physical pleasure, because that's going to take them more into spirituality, closer to Christ, more pious. So this idea of dualism then gets applied to this, because this is the way we think. Good and evil, light and dark, matter, spirit, all these things are these virtual opposites, always in constant opposition to each other. But if we apply that type of thinking to what Jesus is saying here, then the action of judging is separate from the reaction of being judged, the consequence of being judged. They're separated in time because they're two things that are in opposition to each other, two separate things. If you look at legalism, this idea of Roman law, the idea that the law somehow is going to save us. If we can just keep the law right, if we can do that, then we will be accepted. Then we will have a place at the table. Then we get to go to heaven and we can avoid hell. This idea of following the law, conformance, conforming to outside pressure rather than transformance, changing from the inside out. If we apply this idea of legalism to what Jesus is saying, then this wrong or unlawful action of judging necessitates, makes necessary some sort of correction, some sort of punishment. And so we think of it in that terms, in terms of us being punished for what we've done wrong. And then this third concept, we in the West are always thinking of things out there, somewhere. The real significance for us, let's face it, as Westerners, is the future. And the past, as it relates to how we're going to get to that future. But we're task-oriented. We're always thinking in terms of plans and strategies and executive summaries that will take us someplace we need to go. We're builders. We want to build things. We want to grow things. We're always out there someplace. I'll be happy when, fill in the blank, I lose 15 pounds, I get a girlfriend, I get a boyfriend, I get the job, whatever. But it's always out there someplace, and I am strategizing. My present is only the means to that end. That's the way we think as Westerners. If we apply that to Jesus' saying here, then the correction or punishment that is coming as a necessary result of what we did wrong or unlawful is going to be sometime in the future, sometime out there. That's when it's going to come. And possibly it's the next life after we die. All these things give us almost a 180-degree wrong impression of what Jesus is trying to get across here. It fills us with fear. It fills us with the sense that if we do something wrong, you know, we're going to get it. And we constantly go to the past and catalog, okay, did I judge? Did I do this? And if I did judge, did I do, some sort of recompense? Did I go back? Did I fix it? You know, what's going on? You know, raised as a Catholic, did I go to confession? You know, all these things that we think about. If I die right now, am I good enough? Living in fear again. But now let's look at the flip side. How do the Hebrews look at life in terms of these three critical areas? Instead of a dualistic look at the universe, at life, at the world, it's a oneness. The genius of Abraham, the genius of the Hebrews, was to finally see God as one. All of the cultures contemporaneous with Abraham were polytheistic. They had multiple gods, lots of gods. Here, Abraham experiences God as one and realizes that everything in nature is functioning as one in that God. Everything is connected. That oneness redefines everything about the way that you look at life. For the Jews, there is no original sin. We aren't born bad because we're born materialistically in material bodies, and we have to get out of those bodies in order to become pure again, to become holy again. You don't have to exit life in order to experience spirituality. In fact, you dive into life. You experience it fully, become part of it, because it's God's creation and it's good. And that oneness, that connection, is what defines it. So Jesus saying here, when you apply oneness to the idea, is that that action and that reaction, that consequence, are one and the same. It's one action. What we do creates an experience that is the reaction, is the consequence. They're not two things, one thing. When we apply that to this idea of legalism, for the ancient Jews, it wasn't about a legal relationship with their God until the Pharisees got in the act. It was about a relational relationship with God, a love relationship with God, a relationship marked by mercy and compassion, loving kindness, chesed in Hebrew. You apply that idea to what Jesus is saying right now. And the action isn't wrong because it's unlawful. The action is wrong because it breaks down relationship. As soon as we judge another, we create space. They are now object. We are measuring them against some sort of standard. And we are no longer one with them. We have severed the relationship. That's why it's wrong. And then this idea of there then, always being here and out there someplace. The Hebrews were about this life, about this moment. They didn't even have a concept of the afterlife that was doctrinal. You could believe whatever you want to believe, then and now, about what you think the afterlife is all about, because it wasn't important. That was God's domain. If we take care of what we're supposed to do right here, right now, living between heaven and earth, God is just and merciful and good. Everything is going to be fine in the next life, the Olam Haba. Don't have to worry about it. Don't have to think about it. Don't have to theorize about it. Don't have to theologize about it. It is what it is. We just need to do what we're doing here and now. Apply that to what Jesus is saying. And this action or reaction, action and reaction, judging and being judged, are simultaneous. They're one and the same. They're simultaneous. They happen together. It's not a punishment to be judged by the standard which you judge. It's the experience of what happens when you do. Big difference. I want you to think for a second. Whenever you judge someone, you are measuring them against some sort of internal standard that you have accepted mentally. Whether it's a law, whether it's a morality, whether it's an ethical standard, you know, whether it's the beliefs of the group, of your church, of your country, whatever it happens to be. But you have the standard that you are judging them by, judging the external world by. Maybe it's not a person, maybe it's circumstances. Maybe it's a situation you find yourself in. But you're judging it against that standard. But it's your standard. You have accepted it even before you use it to judge something out there, which means you're already living under it. If you believe that a standard creates degrees to God's love, that God loves more or less depending on how well we adhere to a standard, then you're already in that mix. You're already measuring yourself as to where you stand. And typically the way it goes is we'll feel better about our standing if somebody else is down there. So let's push them down there. Let's judge them. Let's make sure that they are something that we can feel superior to so that we can feel a little better about where we stand with God. But the measure that we use is measured to us. God doesn't do it. We do it to ourselves. And it all happens in the moment. Not separated in time, not two separate things, not God being punitive, not God punishing us, or someone else punishing us in a karmic sort of way later on. We do it to ourselves. The experience that we reap from the attitudes and the actions and the choices we make is its own reward, its own punishment. It's all us. And that flows perfectly from what Jesus was saying in Matthew 6. It's the same concept about worrying, about judging. Worry is bad because it takes you out of the moment. Judging is bad because it takes you out of relationship and out of the moment. It's all different facets of the same thing. Jesus is trying to get us to understand. I have a story that I wanted to read you to see if it kind of brings some of this stuff home. Because what's going on here is that the reality that you believe is the reality that you endure. We think that we can perceive reality directly. Whatever you feel about life and the world and your place in it, you feel that that's reality, but really it's not. It's you looking at reality through the filter of what you already believe. I love the example of the Play-Doh factory. Remember those Play-Doh? Did y'all play Play-Doh factories? All right. So you have these little squares that you would slide down, and you stuff the Play-Doh in and have a handle that you could squeeze it out and extrude it, you know? And if the little filter, the little, what would you call that thing? I don't know what you call that thing. The little mold, yeah. The little extruder. If it's shaped like a star, then no matter what shape the Play-Doh is, when it comes out, it looks like a star. You know? If it's shaped like a square, it looks like a square. It doesn't matter. We will see what our belief system allows us to see. The measure that you use to judge is your worldview, is your standard, and you can only see reality through that mold. It will look like that to you and to whoever else you're trying to judge. This is what Jesus is trying to get across. If you want to live in kingdom, then you can't see through your own eyes. You can't see through your own worldview, your own filter. You need to jettison that and see it with God's. When you can do that, you're born again. Then you will see reality as it really is. I like this story. Two men, both seriously ill, occupied the same hospital room. One man was allowed to sit up in his bed for an hour each afternoon to help drain the fluid from his lungs. His bed was next to the room's only window. The other man had to spend all his time flat on his back. The men talked for hours on end. They spoke of their wives, their families, their homes, their jobs, their involvement in the military service where they had been on vacation. Every afternoon when the man in the bed who was by the window could sit up, he would pass the time by describing to his roommate all the things he could see outside the window. The man in the other bed began to live for those one-hour periods where his world would be broadened and enlivened by all the activity and color of the world outside. The window overlooked a park with a lovely lake. Ducks and swans played on the water while children sailed their model boats. Young lovers walked arm in arm amidst flowers of every color, and a fine view of the city skyline could be seen in the distance. As the man by the window described all this in exquisite detail, the man on the other side of the room would close his eyes and imagine the picturesque scene. One warm afternoon, the man by the window described a parade passing by. Although the other man couldn't hear the band, he could see it in his mind's eye, as the gentleman by the window portrayed it with his descriptive words. Days and weeks passed. One morning, the day nurse arrived to bring water for their baths, only to find the lifeless body of the man by the window, who had died peacefully in his sleep. She was saddened and called the hospital attendants to take the body away. As soon as it seemed appropriate, the other man asked if he could be moved next to the window. The nurse was happy to make the switch, and after making sure he was comfortable, she left him alone. Slowly, painfully, he propped himself up on one elbow to take his first look at the real world outside. He strained to slowly turn to look out the window beside the bed. It faced a blank wall. The man asked the nurse what could have compelled his deceased roommate, who had described such wonderful things outside his window. The nurse responded that the man was blind and could not even see the wall. She said, perhaps he just wanted to encourage you. What changed? The outside world was what it was. To a blind man and a man who couldn't see. What changed for the man who was listening to the words of a blind man? His belief system changed, nothing else. But now his whole experience of how he views life and reality will change because of his belief system. The blind man couldn't see a thing, yet lived in a beautiful world. The man with sight sees a blank wall. What we choose to believe changes everything about the experience that we'll have, the attitude that we'll have toward life, and our ability to enter kingdom. Jesus is saying, unless you can become born again, see like a child, be like a child, you can't enter kingdom. The attitude that causes us to judge, to separate ourselves from others, is the absolute death sentence to any experience of kingdom. You can't do it. It's not that you just have to get a little bit better at it. You can't do it. Unless you can drop that whole thing, unless you can, in you someplace, find enough sense of safety in the good news that you can take that first risk-free step or risk-full step. Just risk it. Just go for it and see what happens. You will never experience what Jesus is talking about. You'll never experience the abundant life that he's talking about. That's what he wants us to have. That's what he's trying to get us to do. When we judge, we compare others and that external world to our internal belief system. Whatever that is what we live by. We can't get around it. We have to change it. So when Jesus says the way we judge, that's the standard. Okay, that defines our reality. So if we're looking at people as what? Less than, white trash, heretic, non-believer. As soon as we do that, we're separating them from ourselves. This is our group. We're okay. This is your group. You're not okay. That separation is creating the inability to enter into kingdom. Okay? This is what Jesus is trying to tell us. God doesn't do the judging. That's the important thing for us to understand. God never withholds anything. All we do is cut ourselves off from the free-flowing abundance that is always there for us if we'll just stop, enter into the moment, see what's going on. Now you might be thinking, don't we have to judge? Don't we have to make choices and make decisions about people and about things? I mean, if someone is really untrustworthy, don't I have to judge that person before I enter a contract with them or before I enter into a marriage with them? Don't I have to have some sort of judging process or about a situation or a job or anything? Don't I have to judge? Isn't that what I'm supposed to do? I mean, what are you saying? You know, just let everything in equally all the time? How do I live my life? When something goes against common sense, you know that there's a step missed someplace. And so we got to think about this. What I want to do is get you to distinguish between judging and discernment. Two separate things. If you look in the dictionary under judging, what you will get to judge is to form an opinion or a conclusion about. That's to judge. To discern is to recognize the truth about something. To recognize. What's the difference between those two things? To form an opinion or to recognize something about someone or something else. The opinion that we form, the conclusion that we form, is cognitive. It's internal. We have to form that opinion against some standard. Just what we've been talking about, right? To recognize something is experiential. You have lived through it. You have seen it, he, she, whatever, in action. And your experience tells you what you can and cannot do with that particular person or thing. There's no internal standard that's clouding our vision of reality. In fact, we're seeing reality clearly if we just allow people to be what they are and see what they do. Are they trustworthy? Do they show up on time? All right. Well, then I can do certain things with them. Maybe not other things, but I can do that. This job, this situation, I look at it, I experience it, and I make a choice or a decision about it. But I haven't come to a prejudgment place based on some sort of standard that is internal to me clouding my view of reality. We need to make sure that we understand the difference. Yes, we absolutely have to discern. If we don't, our lives are going to be completely unmanageable. We're never going to be able to make any kind of decision, you know, among things that are not equal. But make sure that that's coming from the experience of the thing and not from a place of prejudgment. That's the difference. We need to discern, but we need not to judge. Can we do that? Can we make that distinction? This is the question. I want to read you another story. I love this story. This is about Mr. Rogers. Okay, if you're old enough to remember Mr. Rogers, you're also old. Who remembers Mr. Rogers? Who's not afraid to admit it? Thank you. I mean, he did keep broadcasting into the 90s at least, so you don't have to be ancient to remember when he was new or anything. But Mr. Rogers and his neighborhood, he was just beloved by children and by adults for decades, right? Some of you don't know that he started out as a pastor. He started out in seminary and moved into television and took on the mantle of ministering to children. And you would never think of that sweet man with a cardigan sweater as being judgmental. But in a book about him, from an interview with him, here's one story about him losing that ability not to be judgmental. And the author writes, "I've only heard Fred Rogers describe himself as judgmental once. It wasn't a word typically associated with him. In fact, his character was more likely to be depicted by judgment's antonyms, merciful, accepting, tolerant. But at least one time he felt the word fit, and its sting changed his life. He was in seminary at the time. As part of his studies and to encourage the development of his homiletic skills, that's what I'm doing, teaching and preaching, he would visit different churches to see how the various ministers preached. While in New England one weekend, he and some friends decided to visit the church of a well-known and well-respected pulpiter. But as the service began, they discovered that the presiding minister was away and a supply preacher, a rather aged one at that, would be speaking in his place. That, of course, was a disappointment. But Fred had heard good things about supplies before, and as well as meaningful messages from older preachers. Unfortunately, this man was neither good nor meaningful. Fred suffered through the sermon, mentally checking off every homiletic rule the man was bending, breaking, or completely disregarding. The sermon went against everything Fred was learning in seminary. And when it ended, mercifully, he later told me, he turned to the friend beside him to commiserate. But before he could say anything, the tears he saw streaming down her face muted his words. She said, "He said exactly what I needed to hear." That bungle of a sermon was what she needed to hear? Fred didn't know what to say. But as he began to ponder the gulf between their reactions, he realized that the essential difference lay within. She had come in need, and he had come in judgment. And because of her need and the sincerity of that old preacher, the Holy Spirit was able to translate the words, poorly constructed as they were, into exactly what she needed to hear. That experience shaped the rest of Fred Rogers' life. Can we start to see the difference of what's going on here? He was judging. She was discerning. And later, Fred, to his credit, was able to discern that the quality of the construction of any message is not essential to the quality of the message received. In fact, I'll tell you what. Half the time, I say things here, you know, some of you will come up and you'll say, "Oh, I just love this and this and this." And I'm thinking, did I really say that? Did I really? Maybe I did. Okay, I'll take credit for it. Thank you. That's great. I'm glad you... You know, things happen. As the words leave our lips and hit the ears of another in the air, the Spirit can do stuff with this, you know? And what we say can have a different complete meaning, but it's valid, and it's what they need to hear. It's the action of the Spirit. We get in the way of that whole process by judging, by taking ourselves out of the moment. If we can just be in the moment, be open to the moment, Even the things that we think we're going to hate can become pleasurable. We can enjoy them. We become involved in them. You know, I don't particularly like country music. It's like nails on a blackboard to me if I'm just listening to it. But put me in a concert, and I can be standing with the rest of them and just going crazy, because it's the moment that takes over and transcends whatever else is going on. If I come in judgment, I miss it all. If I can just come and be, there'll be tears streaming down my face. This is the difference. This is what we can do. We can do this. We can move through life discerning as we need to make the choices we need to make, but never moving over into the judgment that separates us and keeps us out. An opinion is just an opinion. Everybody has one. Check your opinions to see if they're really true, and jettison them if they're keeping you out of the connection with the moment. Discernment is an experienced fact that we need to accept. And if we don't, it's at our own peril. But we need to make sure that we know the difference. You know, judging separates us, makes us condescending toward others, makes love conditional, and that's the bottom line. We can discern truths about things without messing with perfect love. That this isn't a standard. This person who is not measuring up to what we need to do at the moment is not evil, is not less than, is not loved any less than God than I am. They're just not ripe enough for this particular task. Okay, let them ripen. That's fine. Let me ripen, okay? Please, let me ripen in the things that I can't do yet. That's the difference. That's how God sees us. The reality we believe is the reality we endure. Does your reality cause you to be someone who judges, to separate yourself from the moment? Then take a look at that. Take a look at that. I wanted to tell you one other little thing here. I got a text from Tina and Steve Henningsen last night. And TJ, would you put that up on the monitors? Is it up there? Is that the coolest thing ever? Tina and Steve had their granddaughter, Addison, yesterday. When was Addison born, Steve? 3:30. 3:30 in the afternoon. Okay, at least she chose a decent time to be born. That's good. So we're getting all these texts and these Facebook links, and we're looking at this picture of Steve looking really good holding a newborn. And then Tina texts me back later and she says, how anybody can go through the delivery of a baby and not believe that there is a God is beyond me. How do you do that? You know? And then she said, I spent 14 hours in the hospital. But going through that, going through the delivery of that baby, holding that baby in your arms, if you can deny there is no God, how does that happen? The reality we believe is the reality we endure. What do you see when you look into a newborn's face? I mean, what do you see? Do you just see a baby? Do you see another cause for overpopulation in the world? Do you see a black baby or a yellow baby or a white baby and bring your preconceived notions of what that means in life as they grow up to the table? Do you see your granddaughter, in whom you know everything is invested in your life and your family's life? Or do you literally see the face of God? What do you see? You will see what your filter allows you to see. Check the filter. Please, Jesus is saying, check the filter. If you can't see your father's face in a baby's eyes, you got the wrong filter. Don't judge. Come to me. I'm always with you. I will never leave you or forsake you. And my love never runs dry. Let's pray. Father, first of all, we just want to stand with Tina and Steve and their whole family and just celebrate with them this birth and Addison's entry into the world and the joy that that's going to bring to the whole family. So thank you for new birth. Thank you for these children that remind us of what it looks like to enjoy the ride and to live in kingdom the way that you're asking us to. Thank you for that life in our community that it just keeps going on. We see new birth in children. We see new birth in addicts and alcoholics who find sobriety and recovery on the other side. We see changed lives every day. Help us to see that those are absolute miracles. Don't let us rationalize them away because of what we believe in our belief system. Help us change the filter and see everything for what it is. A miracle. Each breath, a miracle. Each moment, a gift from you that you are in the center of. Help us to see life that way so we can really love it and enjoy it and enter into it. Father, thank you for loving us the way that you do. We couldn't take another step if you didn't love us first. We thank you, Lord, and we just ask that we can get deeper and deeper into your space every single day. In Jesus' name, amen. Let's all stand.